like bagels. Have some salad.
All I eat is pizza.
Eat some barbecue.
Apple sauce and some nice red beets.
I always get hungry when I hear that, Rick. I'm like Pavlov's dog here now. I hear the introduction to Prairie Plates. Joining us is Rick Guillon. Rick, welcome.
Good to be back with you, Craig, as always.
Boy, we're going to talk about some fun times today and some good food to go along with it. That's our time at the lake. And we've got a whole laundry list of good food we can think about when we're prepping for what's going to be a great weekend again at the lake, perhaps.
I made this list, and yes, it made me very hungry. And we have a few more weeks in lake season left, so I think we need to talk about some of these late lake season foods like corn on the cob and some of these other things that people really enjoy cooking.
How do you like cooking your corn on the cob?
I actually like it steamed. And I know that's really simple, but when I was a kid, everyone would boil it, but then my grandma would boil it to death, and God bless her. But, you know, she should have steamed it, or I like to maybe steam it a little bit or boil it a little bit first and then throw it on the grill. And I think that gives it a little bit of a chew and sweetness and caramelization, but I kind of have it down to where I like it really sweet and I don't like it overcooked.
A lot of butter. And then do you have a special seasoning that you put on it?
A lot of butter. I just like a little bit of salt, and don't overdo it with corn in my opinion. But in the lakes area in Minnesota, you can find it just off the side of the highway oftentimes. And when I was a kid, it was like $3 a dozen. I mean, it was just ridiculously cheap, but now you're finding it at like $10 a dozen, $8 a dozen, which isn't too bad considering you get like 10 pounds of corn for $8 or whatever the price may be.
This is the time of year when corn just, to me, tastes better.
Yeah, it's delicious. And whether you like it on the cob or off the cob, sometimes I like to cut it off the cob so I don't get it in my teeth and that sort of thing.
Ah, come on.
That's fun, isn't it?
Yeah.
All the butter kind of dribbles down and you need one of those lobster bibs or something. But yeah, it's delicious both ways. And you can put it in corn salsa, that sort of thing, with some black beans and make that cowboy caviar everyone likes. Or just eat it off the cob. You're right.
Cucumber salad is next on your list. My wife loves to make that with our cucumbers out of the garden. It's a great, great plate for the lake.
It really is. Mix it with a little onions, a little scallions. Some people just like straight vinegar, maybe a little sugar. I like a little mayo in it. Some people use cream. Some people use a little yogurt, Greek yogurt probably, because the cucumbers kind of leach out a lot of liquid there, especially when you put salt on them. But yeah, salt and pepper, a little bit of mayo, you're good to go with that, some onion. And yeah, cucumbers this year taste sweet. They're like candy, and I almost just like peel them and quarter them into huge spears, and I just eat them. I put some Malden flake salt on them.
A little ranch dressing for us.
Well, hey, ranch dressing, can't go wrong. Everyone loves ranch around here.
Green bean potato salad, I'm getting ahead of myself, is next on your list. And that also is great, but boy, you need to be careful on how you store it.
Yeah, the mayo version especially, you don't want to leave it out too long. Some people like German potato salad, which is a little more vinegar-based, maybe some bacon, some onions in there, scallions. I like the mayo version with a lot of eggs. I like a lot of eggs, sliced eggs on top with some paprika. My family is German-Hungarian from Hettinger County Regent area of North Dakota. A lot of German-Hungarians. I like a lot of paprika. So that's a good one. But German potato salad, my grandpa always liked to make that on my mom's side, and I've always enjoyed that. He was a good German cook.
Paprika just looks good on the dish.
It does, and people don't think it has any flavor, but they're wrong. It has a little bit of saffron flavor, especially if you can get some good Hungarian sweet paprika or some good Spanish sweet paprika. There's also smoked paprika, smoked Spanish paprika, called pimentón if you're getting really technical, but that can be quite good too, and that's used on barbecue chips a lot. If you want to know what the secret is there, it's usually smoked paprika. So, and then we can get into meats a little bit, like steaks, of course, and the different cuts there. I'm kind of a big ribeye guy.
I had a great T-bone over the weekend, Rick. It was so good.
Nothing wrong with T-bones. Mm-hmm. You get a little of both worlds with the loin strip and then the tenderloin on the back. I try to get the T-bones with the larger tenderloin, more in the porterhouse territory. But then you're paying big bucks. Sometimes they go on sale, though, so watch for that. But, yeah, those bone-in steaks, if it's a ribeye, if it's a T-bone, I mean, there's bone-in a lot of varieties, but it just gives extra flavor, and it keeps the juice in there. People like to gnaw on the bone, too. Not a bad deal.
Chicken at the leg doesn't strike me as much as steak does, but hey.
I like chicken legs, chicken wings. There's a new kind of hot accessory for your Weber charcoal grills called a Vortex these days. It's kind of like a cone with the top cut off, and you put your charcoal in there, and then the chicken wings or chicken legs or chicken thighs go around it kind of on the outside edge of the grill, and it really does a good job. I was at a big wing cook-off at the Moorhead American Legion not too long ago, and that's what the guys were using, that were using charcoal. So it was really kind of an interesting concept, and they loved it, and the wings tasted. I love charcoal-fired anything. Those accessories have really improved over the years. It's not just sticking a can of beer in a chicken anymore, which is good, at least for me.
Okay, we're back in my wheelhouse now with your next idea here, brats. You can't go wrong.
Yeah, I love bratwurst, a lot of different flavors.
Beer brats, Rick, come on.
A lot of people love beer brats. I'm kind of into the straight-up on charcoal, and I do this slump method with the charcoal, and I have to rotate them, so it's really active, but I do drink beer while I'm making these brats.
Cheese infused or no?
I like the wild rice cheddar brats. You can get them at Meats by John and Wayne. There are a few other places in town here that have them. I know probably 3B Meats in Bismarck is a real good one. They probably have that. I like a little cheese in there sometimes, yeah.
Still in my wheelhouse here, Rick. Brisket. I did my first brisket of the season 2 weeks ago. I experimented with wrapping it differently at the end when it was about 170 or so, and I used aluminum foil. I'm never going to do that again, but I think that generally it tasted better. Just the bottom was too leathery.
Yeah, and maybe it was the aluminum foil holding in too much heat and the butcher paper. I'm not an expert brisket
I should have
cooker.
Used butcher paper.
Yeah, that's what the guys in Austin use, yep. And it seems like that really works out well. I'm not an expert brisket cooker. I do like to cook ribs, pork shoulders.
3-2-1 method there?
No, I use a mop sauce, and I spray them every half an hour, so that's what keeps them moist. But that 3-2-1 method, a lot of people swear by, but I tend to think it may overcook the ribs a little bit. It may be a little too long on there. I do like fall off the bone ribs, though, so I don't know. Maybe I need to try it again.
It's the way to go, in my view, but we all have different likes when it comes to running our barbecue, for sure.
Yeah.
Rick, I've never cooked a pork shoulder on my Traeger.
Yeah, they take a long time, but it seems like, well, I know they're very easy to cook, whether it's like a Bradley biscuit smoker or a Traeger or old-fashioned snake method charcoal with a Weber, and that seems to be very popular now, or an electric smoker. They just kind of stay moist. You can overcook them, but you know, a rub and then putting them on there for 12-14 hours, get them to the right temp, and it seems like the pork shoulder's probably the easiest to cook. And if you disagree with me, that's fine too, but that's my experience.
One of the reasons I use a Traeger, Rick, is it's hard to screw up food, I've decided. And if if I were in charge all the time, I think I would be in trouble. But now, Rick, the next thing we're going to talk about is stuff you can cook on a Blackstone, which, man, you see more and more of Blackstones around. I may get one pretty quickly here.
Yeah, you can get really creative with them. I think my favorite thing to cook on them is like Asian-style noodles, like yakisoba noodles are really, really easy because you don't have to boil the noodles ahead of time. They come in a package at the Asian market. You can pick them up and you just kind of add the sauce, stir fry the stuff, put the noodles on, add the sauce. They're really easy. Lo mein noodles, you're probably going to have to boil them first a little bit if they're fresh. If they're dried, you're going to have to boil them a little bit more. The most difficult to do are rice noodles, and I like to soak them ahead of time. The whiter ones, soak them ahead of time in some warm, at an average temperature water. And you got to add sauce constantly to those, but you don't want to boil rice noodles ahead of time. They get really gummy. And so you kind of, go to YouTube and check it out just to see how you do that appropriately.
But Rick, you got to talk about breakfast if you got a Blackstone.
Man, yeah. And that, I love seeing those breakfast photos because people will do pancakes, sausage, bacon, omelets, scrambled eggs, regular eggs, sunny side, all of that stuff. And I love looking at those photos on Facebook of people's Blackstones of breakfast. It just makes me hungry.
Getting outside for breakfast and getting ready to get after it.
Yeah.
All right, Rick, when I was a kid, I didn't like watermelon. When I was a kid, I didn't like cantaloupe. But do I ever now? And boy, perfect for lake food.
Man, this time of year, those melons can really be good. And watermelon, cantaloupe, they grow a lot of good cantaloupe around here too. And you'll see that actually in the grocery store coming up in a few weeks. And they are really good, ripe and sweet.
One thing that's not on your list, Rick, is snacks. What's your go-to snack when you're out at the lake?
Oh, man, that is a really good question. Well, there's nothing wrong with popcorn or chips, Doritos. You know, when I was a kid, I really liked the crinkle-cut Old Dutch potato chips.
I remember those. Yeah.
And I think they're still made in Perham, Minnesota, maybe not anymore. But, man, Old Dutch potato chips or the Campbell thick-cut potato chips dipped in like a French onion dip. They're really good, not very healthy, but whatever.
Rick, before we let you go this week, you lost a friend that I know you want to talk about.
Yeah, a guy named Jeffrey Fonder, he managed Dempsey's Public House, which is not too far away from here, and Dempsey's is kind of a famous pub in North Dakota, downtown Fargo. They don't just serve beer and Irish whiskey. They Italian beef sandwiches, hot dogs, good pizzas, and they're in this kind of circle with Worst Beer Hall and Beer and Fish. And Jeff managed, or Fonder, managed Dempsey's for a very long time and just a very well-known guy in the food and beverage scene in Fargo, and he'll be missed very much. It's a tough loss.
Sorry to hear about that, Rick. Rick Eon, he joins us each week for Prairie Plains. Rick, thanks for coming to Main Street.
You bet, Craig.
More Main Streets ahead. Stay with us.
North Dakota Council on the Arts, in partnership with the ND Main Street Summit, will be hosting its free biannual statewide arts convening, August 27th through the 29th in Watford City. The convening will focus on placemaking, with topics that include the Arts Across the Prairie program, attracting a workforce, asset mapping, creating vibrant communities, and strategic planning. Side trips, town walks, receptions, and many other activities are planned. Learn more about the statewide arts convening at arts.nd.gov.
Main Street continues. I'm Craig Blumenschein. In this segment from the Great American Folk Show, host Tom Brousseau takes us to Taylor, North Dakota, where the community has rallied to restore the Taylor Opera House, a cherished landmark built around 1913.
Let's journey to Stark County in western North Dakota, in the town of Taylor, population 200, and nestled in lush agriculture. The Taylor Opera House, built in 1913, stood the test of time until really not that long ago, when it was nearly condemned. But members of the community came together to save it. Today it has a new facade, it has an awning and a porch, brand new roof, and the charm and the vibe of the inside has been tastefully preserved. Emery Vaughan, one of the Opera House's caretakers, in a moment we'll get into those details. Let me just mention that one of the Opera House's most valuable features comes in the form of a scribble. That's right, you heard me. A scribble. On the back of the tin stage wall, and again on the original backdrop, are hundreds, no, thousands of signatures from the people who have performed there over the years and the national acts that have traveled through, like Lloyd Fixon. I saw his name. He signed it in 1936. and the Taylor Senior Class play. All of them signed it in 1942. George Braig, I'm not sure who he is, but I bet you that folks listening in Taylor right now, they'll recognize that name. George signed it in 1951. And it was really hard not to fall upon one signature in particular, Newman, the popular hypnotist and mind reader who performed there in 1925 and then again in 1928 to standing room only. Hey, what can I say other than it is a beautiful thing when someone stands up to preserve something. Emery, welcome to the Great American Folk Show.
Thank you. Glad to be on.
Born and raised in Taylor, North Dakota.
That's right. Born and raised in Taylor, North Dakota. I was gone for about 20 years and moved back and got pretty active in the community again. And here we go. We redid our opera house. My dad was a postmaster in Taylor. My kids are sixth generation in this area. So this is the Taylor Opera House. When we started remodeling the opera house, back in 2019, there was a lot of discrepancy on when this building was built, and I think I found the most definitive proof. They started probably in April of 1912. We tried to keep it as original as possible, yet still make it safe and very functional by today's standards.
And to what purpose was the Opera House built all those years ago? And we have many opera houses here in the state of North Dakota, and other states do too. But what's the Opera House used for back then?
You know, I got to believe it was for community gatherings, dances, different things like that. We still have the original stage curtain. And if we drop that down, we can see that there was a traveling show that stopped in here in 1913. There's a lot of different shows that have been here back up to the 40s that they would come in, put on a performance or two, and sign the back of our stage curtain.
I was just going to ask you, how did you know that date? But it's because these productions that would come through would actually sign and date the back of the backdrops there on the stage.
Absolutely, yeah. It's really cool. You go up there, you can look at all the tins up on the stage, and you get a sense of the real history of this building.
So we're up on the stage now, and it's a curious thing. As you get closer and closer to the wall, what pops out?
Well, right now I'm looking at Beatrice Elkin was in a play in 1941, April 1st. James Gallagher was in a play in 1938. It seems like every 6 inches you'll find a name of a former high schooler that performed in a play on the stage here, and they... It's just fascinating.
I see a Sherwood Christensen, 1945. My gosh, it looks like this was written almost just yesterday.
Yeah, it's very cool. When the families come back here, when the lighting is really good, they're all like looking for their relatives, and it's really kind of neat.
Well, I must admit that is pretty special, because here their relatives were up on the stage signing a performance. After a performance, and so what a touching thing for relatives to come up here and see that penmanship and see that date. My gosh, as much as this is a community space, it's also a museum. It's also a record of the past.
Oh, definitely. I'd like to drop this curtain that we have here and show you. It's fascinating to see the traveling shows that were here, and they talk about how many people were in this show and the dates, and then when they returned several years later and performed here again.
Never in a million years would I ever think, and I'm standing right now, I have to do this. This is such a beautiful spot, hardwood floor, hardwood walls, but then over here by the kitchen, you see these little black marks, and those are cigarette burns.
Absolutely, yeah. I guess I just flick them over there and hope for good luck or whichever.
So what happens in the Taylor Opera House these days?
A lot of family reunions. You know, well, there's a myriad of events that really happen. The bank hosts a barbecue here or something like that. It's fairly well booked. We're hoping to start having some shows in here.
What did it take to get the Taylor Opera House back into this condition, which is to say absolutely beautiful? What did that take, and who was it that was part of that?
Well, it was myself. I was on the city council, and I'd kind of brought up the idea of, well, maybe we should save it. And so I immediately became the guy to kind of work on that. But the truth of the matter is there was about seven gals in the community that we got together, and they started going getting money. We started talking about what do we want to do, and it seemed like it came together really fast. We were able to fundraise quite a bit of money, and we hired a local contractor that kind of put in a lot of the niceties, made it secure, added the front porch on, which that was never there before. I think it's a wonderful facility.
Was it in jeopardy of being condemned or demolished?
There was definitely enough people that thought, you know, just get rid of it. And I wanted to see this place be part of my kids' chance to come and experience the Opera House. We used to have Christmas Day here. Santa would come and there'd be baskets handed out. And I just think that we got to keep that going.
Well, Emery Vaughan, thank you so much for being on the Great American Folk Show. I've just enjoyed my visit here. I can't wait to jump up on that stage and see some of the backdrops. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and thank you for coming.
That was Tom Rousseau, host of the Great American Folk Show. You can stream current and past episodes at prairiepublic.org and tune in for new episodes every Sunday at 5 p.m. Central right here on Prairie Public. Dakota Datebook is next.
Support for Dakota Datebook is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for August 14th. The Industrial Revolution brought sweeping economic changes in the 19th century. It began in Great Britain and spread to the rest of the world. Ordinary people saw factory owners becoming wealthy, while the workers lived in poverty. Socialism emerged as a response to this economic inequality. When Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels wrote the Communist Manifesto in 1848, socialism became closely associated with communism. The terms were often used interchangeably in the United States. Socialism was a dirty word in the early years of the 20th century. Socialism played a role in the discussions of creating new textbooks for North Dakota schools. The nonpartisan leader noted a clause in a proposed law that would allow North Dakota to print its own textbooks for schools. Book publishers were naturally opposed to this law, which would eat into their profits. The nonpartisan leader accused the publishers of spending money on a campaign to influence politicians and the public to oppose the bill. On this date, in 1919, the Oaks Times raised an alarm, claiming that the way was open for socialist textbooks to be introduced into North Dakota schools. The newspaper warned that several members of the Educational Commission were known socialists. This committee would be tasked with reviewing new school books and recommending books to be placed in schools. The article said, "There is no better way to spread the insidious poison of socialism than to incorporate it into the books used by schoolchildren." The Grand Forks Herald was equally alarmed and warned, "The introduction of socialist textbooks in the schools of North Dakota, if such is done and not detected in time, will be sufficient to fan into a conflagration civic spirit in the state and pave the way for the certain downfall of the Nonpartisan League." The textbook issue was still in the news over a year later. The Grand Forks Herald ran an extensive article detailing what the writer saw as irregularities in how the Educational Commission was handling the matter of textbooks. That, however, was about the end of it. The subject fell off the pages of the newspapers, and public attention moved on. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Ann Olquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for today's edition of Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you have spent time with us. Tomorrow, we'll take you to the Cancer Center at Essentia Health, where we'll delve into why data is revealing a growing concern about cancer among younger Americans. We hope you'll join us for this important discussion tomorrow on Main Street.